I talked it over with Calvin, right? No damned way, were his exact words. Nor could he have hauled all those busters, missiles, and roamers all the way from Alpha Centauri. I stared into space, considering. Mind you, he couldn't have brought them in from a nearby system, either. At least not in one trip. Mac nodded and rubbed his chin. So, either he took two trips, or he had help. Or he's building them locally. Maybe you need to go out farther on the scan. Or, Bill, something I've been thinking about. We use the cloaking for busters and bombs, and that's basically what Medeiros has been using it for. But what if he got the bright idea of cloaking an entire auto factory? I could feel my eyebrows going up. Oh, that would be bad. Then he could be in this system, and we'd have to hit him with a focused pulse to even have a hope of detecting him. Max sighed and sat back in his chair. He looked up at the ceiling, not speaking, for almost a half second. On the other hand, I could be invoking imaginary dangers here. We are completely in the dark on this one. You're up to strength now, right? More or less, Mac waved a hand dismissively. We've got printers, we've got resources, I'm building a new cohort, I have busters to spare, but it looks like I'm going to have to mobilize a system-wide defense. There's a lot of that going around these days, Mac. Look, once you have your cohort up and running, start on more surveillance drones. Give them both long-range and focused scanning capability. I know the chance of hitting something at random with a focused scan is low, but it's not zero. Mac nodded. I stood, gave him a wave, and popped out. Between the others and Medeiros, life was just way too interesting. 43. Course correction. Icarus, March 2240. Interstellar space. I am coming up on Epsilon Indy day. From here, it's a quarter circle. How's your flight path? Daedalus's response came immediately. Checking. I waited for what seemed forever, but was probably a few milliseconds. This was the critical point in our approach. From this point on, we'd each describe a nice, smooth arc terminating at GL-877. But timing became increasingly critical now. I'm right on the money, buddy. Tau is correct. Everything's in the green. Excellent, I responded. Let's go kick some others' butt. 44. Debut. Howard. December 2220. Odin. We flew effortlessly through the Odin skies, our wings beating just fast enough to maintain momentum. The Manta android bodies seemed to be fooling the local wildlife. Prey animals bolted, larger animals circled their young or simply ignored us. Ahead, a flock of blimps moved lazily through a krill field, grazing.
They'll keep an eye on us, but shouldn't otherwise alter their behavior, as long as we don't start chasing the juveniles,
Bridget messaged to me. Got it. Observe, but don't snack.
Ha ha, funny man.
In typical engineering fashion, I'd been content to build drones and observe from afar. Bridget, the moment she'd heard about Bob's Charlie android that emulated a Delton and Marcus's experiments with aquatic versions, had suggested we try something similar. The mantas were a mid-level pack predator, shaped generally like the eponymous Earthfish. As with all Odin life, they contained a hydrogen sac to maintain neutral buoyancy. I had wanted to use helium instead for the androids, but the heavier construction created enough issues without using the less buoyant alternative. We caught up to the flock of blimps. These were the huge animals that I'd spotted on my first deep dive into Odin's atmosphere. They filled a niche similar to baleen whales, feeding on the plentiful small life that seemed to fill the air. We began to circle them, and each blimp kept a huge eye on a stalk pointed our way.
Are you recording?
Yes, dear. Her response was a LOL and a heart emoji.
Reminder, moot starts soon.
Whoops. I messaged Bridget, and she reluctantly agreed to pack it in for the day. We set our androids to autonomous station keeping. They would fly a slow, large circle, avoiding contact with other animals until we needed them again. We popped back into my VR. As usual after a Manta session, Bridget's face was flushed and she wore an ecstatic expression. Are you sure you're up for this? We can still put it off. Bridget lost her smile.
I know, Howard, but I feel like I'm starting to become phobic about it. I have to come out in public sooner or later.
All right, take a deep breath. I took her hand, smiled reassuringly, I hoped, and we popped into the Moot VR. It could have passed for a photograph instead of a live-action scene. Almost 100 versions of my face stared back at us, eyes wide, mouths in the identical O shape. No movement, no sound. Even the Jeeveses had stopped to stare. The tableau held for a couple of milliseconds, then I leaned close to Bridget and stage whispered,
"Don't worry. They're more scared of you than you are of them. Just don't make eye contact."
The room broke up in laughter, and Bobs began coming over to say hi. It was starting to look like we'd be mobbed. Well, Bridget would be mobbed. I might as well have been lint. But I'd carefully timed our entrance. At that moment, Bill gave the blat from his air horn that meant the meeting was starting. Bobs turned to face Bill, and Bridget exhaled a sigh of relief. We maneuvered ourselves to the back to get a couple of beers and watch the Moot without being too much of a distraction. A short, trim man with thick, dark hair walked over and said hello in an Australian accent. I nodded to him and turned to Bridget. "Bridget, this is Henry Roberts. He's from the Australian probe that Linus found in Epsilon Indy." "Henry? Bridget." Bridget made a small show of looking around and said,
"Henry, I only see the one of you. Are you not replicating?"
Henry shook his head emphatically.
"No way, ma'am. Since Linus rebuilt my matrix, I don't feel any need for more of me, nor to explore the universe particularly. Hasn't really gone that well for the Bobs so far. Come on, Henry. Just the one creepy, marauding alien species? That's pretty good, overall." I smiled at him. Henry smirked back, then turned to Bridget. "What about you? Planning to replicate?"
Bridget rolled her eyes.
"I understand why that was the original plan with the Heaven Project, but the whole concept just gives me the shakes."
She looked at me for a moment.
"I don't understand how the Bobs are comfortable with it. It may be related to original Bob's humanistic philosophy."
I cut in. "You're probably right about the humanism, but to say we're comfortable with it is a slight exaggeration. If not for the others and the issue with Earth, I bet there'd be only a few dozen of us." Both Bridget and Henry nodded thoughtfully. Henry replied, "And since you have that covered, I guess we're good. I haven't felt any pressure to contribute copies." "We're resource constrained, Henry. We can only build so many ships per year. Whether they're Bob's or Henry's or Bridget's, doesn't matter. Might as well stick with the current system. At least the new clones come out knowing the full story." Bridget smiled at me before turning back to Henry.
"So what are you going to do with yourself to keep busy?"
Henry looked surprised for a moment, then grinned.
"To tell the truth, Bridget, I'm on my way to Omicron Squared Eridani right now. I'm going to get an android body made, land on Romulus or Vulcan, and build a sailboat. Then I'll spend a decade or two sailing the whole planet. In fact," he added after a moment's thought, "I think I'll try to sail every ocean of every planet in the human sphere. Chances are I'll never catch up."
I laughed and nodded my head in Bridget's direction. "And she is going to catalog every species on every planet in the human sphere."
"Damn betcha. What's it to you?"
Bridget glared at me in challenge. Henry chuckled. "Well then, I expect I'll run into you from time to time." Bridget responded with her nuclear-powered laugh, and Henry's eyes widened slightly.
"Yeah, she affects people like that." I'd made sure to preserve Bridget's mannerisms as faithfully as possible. Henry's reaction showed that the laugh was as effective in VR as it had been in real life. I frowned for a moment. She didn't laugh as much as she used to, though. I wondered if that was because of replicant variations or her recent experiences.
Have you used one of the human androids yet?"
Henry was making a visible effort to get himself back on an even keel. Bridget shook her head and looked at me.
"Howard's been trying to get me to try it. I think I'm just going to take it slow. And I'm worried about running into my children.
But she's okay flying an alien predator around on a gas giant. I winked at her and she grinned back. Henry chuckled, then turned to face the front as Bill finished his opening speech. First item on the agenda was always the others, preparation for and status of. No one wanted to miss anything. Bill's summary was short and to the point. The harvesting of Delta Pavonis continued, the Bobs still didn't have any way of stopping it, and no one had a plan. Outstanding. 45. Pav arrival. Jacques, May 2247, HIP 84051. I settled into an orbit around HIP 84051-2. It was a young planet of a young star, according to the survey. Native plant life hadn't reached the angiosperm stage, and animal life hadn't figured out endothermia yet. I hoped that Phineas and Ferb had managed to pick up a lot of genetic samples on Pav before the others arrived. According to updates from Bill over the last few decades, recreating plants and animals from samples was getting a lot easier. Of course, that comment was based on Earth life, with which we were very familiar. Extraterrestrial stuff would take some more work. Mind you, we didn't have to decant the Pav right away. Life forms didn't suffer degradation in a stasis pod. We could take our time, figure out the Pav biology, get the process working, then wake up the refugees. I'd like that. I checked the notes on HIP 84051. The Bob that explored and reported this system was named Steve. There was no indication where his name came from. Maybe Steve Dallas from Bloom County? As good a guess as any. It wasn't worth pinging him just to ask, even assuming he was connected to BobNet at the moment. I spent a month going over his notes while I waited for Phineas and Ferb to arrive. Steve went into considerable detail about climate, ecology, geology, and such. He seemed to be a bit of a keener. Despite the fact that I was in a new star system, I found myself just going through the motions. I had no energy, no enthusiasm. It took me a while to realize what was wrong. I finally figured out that there was no joy here. This wasn't expansion. This wasn't a new colony, whether for humans or, in this case, Pav. This was being chased out. This was fleeing from a home that had been perfectly suited to them, to take refuge somewhere else that was nothing more than the best alternative available. The thought was dangerously depressing. I had to get out of this funk or I'd be no good to anyone. I waited until the colony ships were close enough, then popped in to visit. Hi, Phineas.
Hello, Jacques. Pull up a chair. Survey okay?
I settled into an overstuffed easy chair. No surprises. Not the greatest. Kind of a Devonian level of ecosystem. They can live there.
Right?
Phineas looked at me searchingly. You've got a bit of the Dickie Downer thing going, I think. I laughed. Guilty as charged. There's nothing about this whole situation that doesn't suck donkey balls. I guess it's just gotten to me. Well, I have been following Bill's blog on somatic regeneration from genetic material.
Wow, that's really good, Phineas. I could hear the capitals.
Nyuk, nyuk. Anyway, Ferb and I batted it back and forth during the voyage, and we took a look at the samples we have in stasis, and we think we could get Bill's techniques to work on Pav biology. Huh. Okay. So we hold off on decanting them for a while so you can try out your ideas? I think so. The delay won't harm them, and I'd like to hand them something a little better than this raw planet. I nodded. Good. Let's do that. I already felt better. 46. City. Howard, June 2221, Odin. Bridget found me lounging in my office, feet up on my desk, gazing abstractedly at a hologram floating in the air.
What's that?
She pointed at the image. You know how Marcus created those flying cities on Poseidon?
Mm-hmm, Bridget replied. And a thorough shitstorm along with them. I read blogs, too.
I grinned at her.
Well,
it got me thinking. Odin is this huge freaking planet, and if you're going to go all floating city, why not here?
Okay. Is that his design?
No, I gestured at the hologram. I don't need surge coils to stay afloat. Turns out normal earth pressure air in an enclosed bubble will float in Odin's atmosphere at the 1.5 bars level. I've designed the city within a prolate spheroid, which will be very stable and more than strong enough with carbon fiber reinforced materials.
Sure, but who's going to live there?
Well, I was thinking maybe us. Bridget raised an eyebrow at me.
Howard, are you forgetting what VR stands for?
No, dear. I grinned at her as she stuck her tongue out. I'm thinking android bodies. Our very own city in the clouds. Don't say I never give you anything.
You, sir, have far too much time on your hands.
I nodded, then lost my smile. Seriously, though, Bridget, this whole thing with the others, it's not out of the question that we might end up having to hide human colonies in gas giants to avoid getting wiped out.
The Bobs are really concerned about this species, aren't they?
Bridget's eyes showed her concern. Yeah, Bridge. Delta Pavonis really kicked the stuffing out of us. I feel kind of bad that I'm not more involved in the war effort. I guess this is my contribution.
So we'd be the beta testers.
Bridget sat down at my desk and examined the model more closely. Yep, and of course, we can't really be hurt if things go bad. Bridget poked a finger at the model and turned it this way and that. She examined it in silence for several milliseconds. Then she turned to me.
And a front row seat to watch Odin life in action. Okay, Howard, you've been wanting to get me involved in a printing project. Let's see what we can do.
47. Foreboding. Riker, December 2240, Seoul. Bill stared into space, slowly twirling the glass of whiskey in his hand. I'd managed to tempt him with a scan of one of the more recent vintages from Vulcan. Funny, Vulcan had become the acknowledged expert in alcoholic products, real or VR. Howard's company, well, the Brodeur family's company, was even financing construction of some AMI-controlled starships to start trade routes between systems. I privately thought that might be a little premature, but I guess life goes on, even with the threat of an alien menace. In any case, the project gave people something positive to focus on, so what the hell? It's not bad, Bill said. Original Bob would have approved, and he'd have slowly gotten tanked without realizing it. I think this would sneak up on you. I grinned at the image. Yeah, pretty sure, I hesitated and shifted in my chair. Bill saw the movement and raised an eyebrow. Okay, so this isn't just a social call. I sort of assumed anyway. What's up, Will? There's been no activity from the others, Bill. Nothing. No sorties, no attacks, no nothing. It smells. Granted, but how much of that is just us being on edge? I'm wondering if a quick examination of GL-877 might be in order. I tried to keep my voice casual, but the expression on Bill's face showed me I'd pretty much failed. I get it, Will, but we have to balance any knowledge we might gain against the possibility of them capturing some of our tech. They haven't tried again with the monitor drones in the Oort, but if we sent something in-system... I'd been giving this some serious thought, so Bill's objection wasn't really a surprise. And I had my answer ready. They can't capture our tech if we don't send any new tech inbound. I'm suggesting an incursion using only common tech. Surge, level one, Sudar, so on. No scut, no cloaking. Bill's eyebrows rose on his forehead. Okay, how will that work? I popped up some schematics. We disguise the probes in an asteroid-like coating. It'll block casual Sudar pings and full radar and visual inspections. Just another piece of space junk floating through the system. The units will store their observations for retrieval on the way out, or they'll transmit everything and self-destruct if they see anything approaching. They? As many as we can build. Send them in at all kinds of angles and speeds. Bill stared into space, silent for several milliseconds. It does actually sound like a no-downside kind of plan. What the hell? Let's talk to Mario. It's up to him in the end, but I bet he'll go for it. I can do that, Mario nodded in thought for a moment, then looked at us. I've got auto factories about a quarter light year out ready to pump out more replacement monitor drones if the others get uppity again. Something like what you describe would be dead easy. He rubbed his chin. Little bit of a pain to get everything into position, but we've got the time, I guess. If the others suddenly make an appearance, you'll have your answer anyway. I nodded in agreement. Good, and let's face it, we might see nothing but more Dyson sphere construction, but if we find a massive fleet of death asteroids and cargo vessels being prepped, I'd kind of like for it not to be a surprise. Mario grinned at me. Got it. I'll get started. 48. Pav decanting. Jacques, July 2256, HIP 84051. Residences for 20,000 Pav? Check. Big honkin' fence to keep out the native wildlife? Check. Farms with Pav crops already starting to grow? Check. Pav farm animals taking first steps on wobbly new legs? Check. Okay, this wasn't half bad. We'd gone a little overboard with the residences, probably some displaced guilt in operation, but it looked like we were ready. Phineas and Ferb sat, holding coffees, waiting for me to open the conversation. For some reason, I found myself reluctant. Up to this point, we'd been able to avoid really dealing with the whole Pav thing. Analyzing their biology was fun and interesting, and building a colony site was just the adult version of Lego. But now we'd be waking up the last 20,000 members of an all-but-extinct species. And, of course, dealing with their questions, accusations, and our feelings of guilt over the whole Delta Pavonis thing. I sighed and put my coffee down on the side table. Okay, guys, enough procrastination. I gestured to Phineas. You first. Phineas gave me a crooked grin, acknowledging the awkwardness. We've got everything ready. The site is ready, crops are growing, animals are doing what animals do. We've got drones doing most of the maintenance labor, but we'll either have to step in with androids or start waking Pav pretty soon. Right. This colony isn't going to run itself. I looked at Ferb. We'll be offloading your colonists first. Any issues? Ferb shook his head in reply. No. I'm completely ready. More than. I want to get heading for Sol as soon as possible. Maybe we can get a load of humans out of there before the others show up. Assuming they do. Ferb rolled his eyes. Geez, Phineas, grow a brain. Phineas shrugged without further comment. Anyway, I said, trying to forestall what had become an ongoing argument. You'll be able to unload all your colonists. 3 days, right? Ferb nodded. Yeah, we'll take our time so we don't have too many awake but helpless Pav sitting around at any time. After the first load, the Pav can explain the situation to each new batch. Ugh. I dropped my head into my hand and massaged my forehead for a few moments. I'm not looking forward to that either. Even with Hasjiar to help, it's going to be chaos. Even more than normal Pav chaos. We woke Hasjiar and the other 7 Pav that Bill and I had originally spoken to. They were calmer this time, possibly helped by the food we'd decanted for the occasion. The destruction of the meal complete, Hasjiar looked up in the general direction of the wall monitor. What now? Phineas, Ferb, and I exchanged glances. Well, here goes nothing. I replied through the wall monitor. I'm going to come in person to discuss next steps with you. I want you to be prepared. All 8 Pav went into alert posture, heads swiveling in all directions.
Is there danger?
Hasjiar asked. No. I just think it's time we met face to face. I gave the guys a lopsided grin. I just hope they're not still hungry. It took only moments to enter the android and go through startup checks. I undraped myself from the support rack and walked to the door. A short walk down the hallway, and I stood outside the room containing the revived paths. I took a deep breath, muttered, "Showtime," and signaled the door to open. As I entered the room, the Pav retreated en masse to the far corner. The tableau held for several seconds, a seeming human being at one end,
and a pack of 6-foot-tall meerkats standing at alert at the other. I discussed it with Bill, and we decided that showing ourselves as alien would be better than trying to pass off a PAV form. Just the same, a certain amount of awkwardness seemed reasonable. I glanced at them, but avoided a steady stare, which could be interpreted as aggressive. Instead, I walked to the long table and sat down on the bench. "Good day," I said to the group. "I'm Jacques. Once again, I'm sorry to be meeting you in these circumstances." There was no movement for several seconds, then Hasjar sidled over and sat on the other side of the table. After a brief silence, she gestured to me.
"Why did you not show yourselves last time?"
There was no reason for Hasjar to know that I was not flesh and blood. Why complicate things? "We didn't want to alarm or distract you unnecessarily. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision." She nodded, apparently satisfied. The other 7 PAV began to tentatively move toward the table. I ignored them, hoping they would take it as encouragement.
"What shall we discuss?"
Hasjar asked. I carefully avoided smiling. "To the PAV, that would be a challenge. Your new home is ready for you. We have 20,000 of your people in stasis, and I'd like to discuss plans for awakening them." Hasjar nodded again and visibly settled herself more comfortably on her seat. As a city councilor by profession, administrative considerations were her job, and the familiar ground seemed to reassure her.
"Very well, Jacques. What do we have to work with?"
Hasjar swept her gaze over the fields, where the first key crops, a sort of above-ground potato, were just beginning to ripen. We sat on the patio of Hasjar's home, while 3 PAV soldiers fingered their weapons and eyed me suspiciously. I smiled to myself at their expressions and body language, careful not to let it reach the android's face. The PAV were constantly perplexed by our behavior, but seemed willing to put it down to our alienness. The military personnel, for instance, had been surprised and suspicious when we simply handed them their weapons after awakening them. They'd checked their ammo, and several had taken test shots. They still seemed to think it was some obscure practical joke, and were bracing for the punchline. Hasjar turned to face me.
"What of the others? Will they still be a threat to us?"
"We suspect that they are heading for our home right now. They were angry at our actions in your home system. We're preparing for them. But you're pretty far away from their home world now."
"And still, you do not seek payment?"
"It's not how we work, Hasjar."
"You are Dojagril."
"Critters with broken brains." I laughed, careful to use the PAV version of humor. "Many of us would agree."
"So why do you do this?"
I shifted in my chair. A desire to help, partly, and, I think, feelings of guilt because we were there when the others arrived and we couldn't stop them.
"The results would have been the same had you not shown up, would they not?"
Hasjar cocked her head at me in a very human-like expression. This was old ground. There seemed to be some concepts on which our species just couldn't seem to connect. "I know, Hasjar, our reactions don't always make complete sense, even to us." Hasjar laughed.
"On that, at least, we are very similar."
She motioned to the fields.
"What now?"
"As I've said before, we'll be as present or as absent as you want. We'll keep you up to date on what happens with the others and help you if you want to go back to PAV. Or even just take a look." Hasjar shuddered.
"I suspect it will be many years before any of us can stomach that. I still have nightmares from the images. The day you first woke us."
I nodded, not saying anything.
"Our people have settled in well. The residences are generous and well-designed. The animals of this world have already learned not to bother us."
She eyed me speculatively.
"Are there more surprises you may have for me?"
"No, Hasjar." I shook my head before remembering that the PAV expression of negation was a side-to-side wag. I adjusted my movement and Hasjar laughed.
"It is okay, Jacques. I am starting to learn your expressions as well."
"I appreciate that, and no, I think we've got it all covered. You have good mineral deposits within easy distance, You'll be able to build up an industrial base within a few years. There's nothing on this planet big enough or mean enough to give you trouble. I chuckled. Unlike some of the other planets that we have colonized, you don't appear to have any flying nasties to worry about. Possibly they haven't evolved here yet.
That word again. I know you have explained it to our physicians. There is much argument.
Hasjiar sat silently for a few seconds.
You mean well, but your existence, and even your casual conversation, contains thoughts and ideas that perhaps we are not ready for.
After a moment, she stood up.
Perhaps our children will be better prepared. Thank you, Jock, for the information. And for everything you've done, I will convey this to the council, and we'll use the communicator if we need to talk more.
It was a dismissal. Well, it could have been a lot worse. At least they weren't shooting at us on sight. We exchanged the standard PAV head bob, and I stepped off the porch. The cargo drone settled to the ground in front of me, and I noticed the soldiers going into high alert. And why not? For a civilization in which a steam engine was the latest in high tech, floating spaceships would be beyond explanation or even description. They understood the reality now in principle, but still not right down in their non-existent boots. I climbed into the cargo bay, then turned to face the soldiers. As the doors started to close, I gave them the Vulcan salute.
49. Surveillance. Riker, November 2248, Seoul. A ding announced the arrival of an email. I swiveled in my chair and pulled it up in the holotank. From Mario. This could be interesting. It had been 8 years since Mario started on my suggested plan to investigate the Other's home system. The lead time was inevitable, of course. The drones couldn't fall through the system at interstellar speeds and go unnoticed. And falling in from the Oort was a slow process otherwise. Oh, Mario had given them a good push, but hopefully not enough to set off alarms. I paged through the documents, scanning the headers, then reading interesting items. When I was done, I sent a video chat request to Mario. He popped up right away. Hi, Will. You looked through the stuff?
Yeah. Looks like they got suspicious in the end.
Mario laughed.
Uh-huh.
Started shooting down every piece of debris they could detect, including a lot of just plain old rocks, which is fine with me.
But the stuff you did get...
Right. Construction of the sphere proceeds apace, Mario thought for a moment. What was of more interest was the almost complete absence of death asteroids and cargo vessels.
I noticed that, Mario. In fact, the Delta Pavonis expedition would account for every unit we could see.
So, either that's all they've ever had, Mario frowned into the video, or everything else is out somewhere.
I nodded.
And you've got eyes on every system in the area.
Yep. Ain't no harvesting going on, no how.
I sat back, staring into space. Thanks, Mario. I think that settles it, at least for me. I'm going to recheck my detection array.
Mario nodded and closed the video.
Yep, no question. Something wicked, etc. Bradbury had nothing on this.
50. A Space Odyssey. Bob, April 2225, Delta Eridani. Marvin laughed so hard he was in danger of sliding out of his lazy boy, prompting Spike to leap up and scamper under one of the side tables. I waited patiently for the drama to end.
That's great, Marvin wiped tears from his eyes. I'm just sad that the Deltans will never get the reference.
Well, we can explain it to them when we meet, even show them the movie.
So it's a strong magnetic anomaly on the largest moon?
Yep. I grinned at him, and a big black monolith in the center, dimensions 1x4x9. Except this one will have writing on it, or maybe in it.
You are evil.
I thought about having it play the opening music to 2001, but with no air and all. Marvin laughed again and shook his head. I strolled through Camelot, enjoying the scents and sights of people at work, at play,
cooking meals or just relaxing. Over at one end of the common area, Archimedes sat with his three apprentices, holding up and slowly rotating a flint nodule while he talked. The Caerleon residents had been dubious at first, but a bag full of Archimedes' best spear points had silenced all but the most paranoid. In short order, a dozen Deltans had shown up on Archimedes' doorstep, ready to be trained. 2 months later, the group had been reduced to these three, the smartest, or at least most determined, of the volunteers. Archimedes admitted to me in private that they didn't totally suck. With the reduction in tension, both Caerleon and Camelot had discovered opportunities for trade. For one, the weird, giant, potato-like tubers that the Deltans favored grew in profusion around Caerleon. Small crafts, straightened spear and arrow shafts, even labor for things like building tents, ensured a steady growth of commerce. Not bad. Archimedes paused in his lecture for a coughing fit. The symptoms worried me. The coughing started after the beating he'd gotten during the abortive kidnapping. It wasn't getting worse, but it wasn't particularly getting better either. I resolved to get a Sudar scan, if I could arrange it. Finally, the group broke up, the three Caerleon residents heading back home for the night. I walked over to Archimedes, who was stretching carefully. "That side still bother you?" I asked.
"I don't think it'll ever go away, Robert. I don't think the bone set properly."
Archimedes grimaced and tried to work the muscles around the tight area. Once again, I felt a moment of helpless rage that I'd been unprepared for the tactic and unable to do more. We headed for the mesa to get some late afternoon sun. On the way up, I had a flashback to a time, 57 years ago, when I would make this trek up the path as a floating, football-sized drone alongside a much younger Archimedes. He now looked very much like Moses had back then. I supposed this was the same thing people went through when they suddenly realized their parents wouldn't be around much longer. Archimedes claimed his favorite spot, and I settled down beside him. As I swept my gaze over the panorama, I realized that nothing much had changed. The Deltans hadn't yet reached the stage where they would deliberately start clearing forests. Maybe it was a good thing I'd never gotten around to teaching them to domesticate livestock. There really was no hurry. 51. Moot. Bill, June 2230, Epsilon Eridani. I waited for the catcalls to die down. More than 100 bobs looked back at me, and this wasn't close to all of us. The war effort was now producing a couple of dozen new bobs per year, over several systems. Herschel and Neil huddled together near the front of the crowd, whispering and preparing notes. They'd be giving one of their regular updates on the Bellerophon. The two bobs were as inseparable as Calvin and Goku, except less quarrelsome. As a youth, I'd always wished for a brother. I wondered if some bobs in the same cohort got into that mode for just that reason. Okay, everyone, we've got updates from Oliver, Will, myself, and Dexter on bob production. I'll be giving a summary. Herschel and Neil will give us an update on their excellent adventure. Garfield will give a report on weapons research and on the Casimir Power Core. After that, it's open floor. There were a few clink sounds as bobs dealt with coffees and beers, but everyone was all business now. I went through the reports, projections, and graphs on replicant production. Bottom line, folks, we expect to have close to 500 Dreadnought-class vessels available for the defense of Earth. About half will be staffed by AMIs carrying H-bombs. We've already decided not to try to build a defense for Epsilon Eridani. If they show up there, I'll just blow everything up and bail. And on that subject, Mario? Mario stepped forward. We've rebuilt the surveillance and monitoring system around GL-877. The other's Delta Pavonis expedition is back home, but there's been no other activity. We don't know enough about their habits to know if that's unusual. The quick sequence of sorties to GL-54, NN-4285, and Delta Pavonis might have been an exception, or they might have enough material to keep them busy for a while. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Neil frowning and shaking his head. I resolved to ask him about it. The questions quickly ran down on the military buildup.
Herschel and Neil were up next. Herschel stammered and blushed when their turn was announced, but soon got it under control.
Nothing really new, other than exploratory notes. We're continuing to investigate the interior of the Bellerophon, and although we're able to answer some questions that have been asked, we just keep running into new questions. The ship appears to have been multi-purpose. Moving mining cargo was just one intended use. The way the cargo bays can be reconfigured, Herschel shook his head, telegraphing the perplexity that shaded every one of their written reports. The Bellerophon blog was currently one of the most popular on BobNet, so this was more review than anything. There were one or two pro forma questions, then the two stepped back with relief written all over their faces. Garfield stepped forward. We've been pursuing militarization on two fronts, improvement of existing weaponry and creation of new modes. The second hasn't been all that fruitful. We've managed to build big honkin' lasers, and they're a little more effective against big enemy ships than plasma spikes, but like the spikes, they suffer from an inability to follow the enemy. Where light speed lag is a significant factor, if the enemy changes direction after you've fired, you've just wasted a shot. Garfield looked around at his audience. Intelligent weapons remain our best tactic, especially the ones that go boom. We're working on hardening delivery drones against the zaps, and we're working on bigger and better bombs. Garfield looked at me, and I added, but in the end, our best strategy seems to be numbers. Lots of bobs, lots of bombs. Will, after a moment, stepped forward and said, we're pursuing the problem on three fronts. One, defensive soul. Two, stopping any other expeditions. And three, some kind of final solution. If they attack Earth before we're ready to defend it, none of the rest matters. But we can't just fight a defensive game either. He paused for a moment and his gaze swept the audience. It means we're splitting our efforts. And it means an assault on GL-877 will be farther in the future than we'd like. But defense of the Earth comes first, and the longer they wait before launching an expedition, the more prepared we'll be. Assuming they haven't already. There was dead silence in the moot as we all turned to look at Neil. He was frowning. Herschel was blushing a perfect shade of tomato. Explain, please, I said to him. Neil looked down for a moment. Remember when the others started cleaning house around their system, then stopped? Why did they stop? Maybe because they'd done what they wanted, which was to launch something through a blind spot, and we did the predictable thing. We moved our surviving drones to the near side. Garfield and I looked at each other in consternation. If what you're saying is true, Garfield finally said, then they're circling around, rather than going directly towards Sol. And space is big. We'd never detect them except by accident, I added. Will looked at me. We'd better run some models.
Yeah, space is big. Bigger than I thought. I looked at the spreadsheet in dismay.
A circle of 12 square light years. That's what we have to monitor. Garfield rubbed his forehead wearily. Almost 80,000 drones.
Which will cut into the stasis pod construction, I said.
And the bomb construction, the Bob construction, the colony ship construction, and all the other maintenance stuff we still have to support. Will looked up at the ceiling and silently mouthed an F-bomb. It never stops.
We have no choice, though. If the others come swooping in with no warning, we're dead.
I thought for a moment. At least we don't have to produce them all at once. The most direct path from GL-877 has to be covered first. And we can work outward to cover more circuitous trajectories.
Will stood up with a groan. Right, I'll talk to Oliver, see if he can contribute. We still have a few decades before the earliest that the others could get here. Deliveries from Alpha Centauri would arrive in plenty of time.
Good idea, Will. I looked around at the other Bobs.
It looks like, as usual, we will be living in interesting times. Woo! Ha!
52. Waiting. Riker, February 2252. Sol.
Well, that's it, Will. They're now completely dependent on us.
I turned to look at Charles, slumped in his chair. The weariness was psychological, of course. VR avatars didn't get tired, unless we wanted to. But if ever there was a reason to just give up, even for a few moments, this was it. The report had just come in and was sitting in my holotank. The last viable large-scale farming operation had failed. Almost complete loss of the crop. Not nearly enough saved to make up seed stock for the next year, even if nothing was allocated to consumption. Right, I sighed. So do we reallocate our dwindling supply of metal to make more farming donuts to keep them fed? Or more colony ships to get them off planet? Charles knew the routine and slid smoothly into the mantra. Or stasis pods to put some people on ice to reduce the pressure on supplies. I finished the litany without emotion. It was old news. Geometric progression sounded great on paper, but it assumed you had infinite resources to draw upon and no external pressures. The reality was less forgiving. So what now, Will? Well, the good news, if you can call it that, is that without any more farming requirements, we can start moving enclaves underground. Yeehaw! This will be a fun session. You want to join? Charles shook his head. Not even on a bet. Let me know how it goes. And with that, he popped out. I grimaced. Yeehaw, indeed. The UN meeting was quiet, even by recent standards. Everyone present understood that the event, although small in itself, represented a watershed moment for humanity. Minister Sabrina Scott currently had the floor. She gazed into the camera for a moment.
Mr. Riker has provided his projections based on each option moving forward. None are attractive. All have risks. We face some hard choices over the next several sessions, and we no longer have the luxury of interminable debate. I am therefore going to ask for a non-binding vote at the end of each and every session. The first time that we get more than 50% for one of the options, I will move for a binding vote.
Scott relinquished the floor, and I noted that it was several seconds before anyone asked to be recognized. In the old days, it would have been a free-for-all. Not for the first time, especially recently, I recognized a feeling of despondency. I would have to get that under control. The last thing they needed was to see me giving up hope. And there was still the Bellerophon. They had enough material to build stasis pods for every single human being on the planet once they arrived and we could get our considerable manufacturing capability focused on the task. The question, of course, would be whether we'd have time to do that before the others showed up, assuming they showed up. And if they showed up late to the party, would they be content to just cook the planet and be done? Or would they come after us? This was a well-worn groove, and I couldn't afford the time to keep tracing it. Back to work. 53. Protection. Bill. August 2230. Gamma Pavonis. Claude gave me an unbelieving look.
Come on, Bill. Do you seriously think we'll just leave?
I sighed and rubbed my eyes with thumb and forefinger. VR or not, it still felt good. I was visiting Claude's VR, which was currently a beach scene, complete with gulls, sand, and deck chairs. I was impressed with the level of detail. The breeze felt cool and smelled salty, and the sand was warm on my bare feet. The overall effect was seductive. With an effort of will, I brought myself back on task. I'm not trying to order you to, Claude. It's not like I have any authority. But you were at the moot. Neil is probably right, and the others are probably heading for Earth. We need...
That's a lot of probabilities.
With a large downside if the statement turns out to be right. Claude was beginning to get my goat, and I delivered this statement with a glare. He must have picked up on it because Claude held up his hand in a fending off pose.
Hey, no offense, big guy. But there's some significant downside here as well. Gamma Pavonis 3 is an ideal colonization target for humans, and the system is probably high on the list of targets for the others. This isn't clear-cut.
I know, Claude, and it would be a major downer if the others harvested this system, but I don't think you're being entirely rational.
Gamma Pavonis is a colonization candidate, but at the moment, that's all it is. There's no one here, other than you and the other Bobs, I mean. No one would die if the others show up. No humans, no non-human intelligences. On the other hand, if they're heading for Earth... Got it, Bill, got it. But assuming Neil is right, we'd get there just in time to join the fight, but not really in time to do anything in the way of preparations. I looked up and took a deep breath. We seemed to be circling the drain again. After the loss at Delta Pavonis, Claude had returned to Gamma Pavonis, accompanied by a couple dozen surviving Bobs, and vowed to protect Gamma Pavonis at all costs. It was a noble goal, but in my opinion, misguided. Thus, this meeting, which so far wasn't going well. I dropped my gaze back to Claude and gave him my hardest glare. The same could be said of staying here. If they show up tomorrow, you've got nothing. Not quite nothing, Bill. We've been prepping since we got back here from Delta Pavonis. If the others group that hit Delta unloads in GL-877, then turns right around and heads here, they still can't get here in less than another decade. And we're going heads down, ass up, taking advantage of geometric progression to build a large enough defense force. And for what? There's no damned way that Will is going to send a colony ship here, not while the others continue to be a threat, right on your doorstep. Which brings us to your plan to take the fight to the others. And not to put too fine a point on it, but you aren't doing anything to help us prepare for something like that. We talked about that at the moot as well. Claude was glaring at me now. We were definitely covering old territory. And we would reach the same conclusion. We can't split our efforts, Claude. Right now we're not sure if we'll be prepared when the others show up, and that's without sending some of our assets your way. If we can get you guys to Earth in time, you'll need more than numbers, Bill. Delta Pavonis taught us that. 1 million buster-sized pinholes in the Death asteroids and cargo ships won't take them down. You need nukes. You need exactly the same stuff that you're building for the defense of this planet. Look, Claude, we've been over this before. Hell, I just caught myself starting to recite my arguments in a sing-song tone. Talk about rehearsed. We're splitting our resources and efforts by protecting a second beachhead. It's as simple as that. We exchanged glares for a few milliseconds, but it was clear that nothing had changed, and no one was going to concede anything. Stalemate. Again. I nodded and stood up. Okay, if anything changes, we'll revisit things, of course. Claude gave me a shrug, the closest I was going to get to a concession. I raised my hand in salute and popped out. I hadn't really expected to win Claude over this time, but the failure still rankled. I couldn't take time out to pout, though. My next scheduled stop was in Delta Pavonis. We still had a lot of hardware in the system, in the form of drones. As far as I knew, all the Bobs had left by now, but we still needed to keep an eye on things. I took over a drone that was parked in orbit around DP-4 and trained the optics on the planet below. I hadn't yet decided if this habit was essential monitoring or some form of penance. Either way, every time I looked at the planet, my guts twisted in knots. It had been 13 years since the others scoured the planet clean, and the normal cleansing effect of weather was starting to show. The planet didn't look quite as gray. The polar caps, especially, were back to a brilliant white. The oceans were beginning to show more blue than gray as well. Unfortunately, the land was all grays and browns, and that wouldn't change. Jacques, every bit as stubborn as his clone mate Claude, had refused to give up any of the samples he'd taken. He'd explained, reasonably enough, that the biosamples were intended for the PAV on HIP-84051-2, and he wasn't going to take a chance on his inventory. He did promise to take more samples if and when everything was established on the new planet. It wasn't completely unreasonable. I snorted in amusement at the thought. Jacques wasn't unreasonable, but his impatience with discussions could be irritating. More of that Bobbian variation between clones, apparently. Well, whatever. It might take 50 or 100 years, but eventually I wanted to start rebuilding the PAV ecosystems. It would be great, someday, to offer the PAV their old worlds back.
and the metals issue could be dealt with. But Claude was right about one thing. None of this was practical as long as the others continued to be a threat.
54. Party. Riker, March 2257, Romulus. I knocked on the door, still not sure if I really wanted to be here. Oh, I was always happy to see my relatives, but Justin, the door opened, and one of Justin's great-granddaughters opened the door. Beatrice, I remembered. She'd been introduced to me on one of the video chats a few years back.
Uncle Will, come on in. Grandpa's in the sitting room.
She shut the door behind me and pointed, then was off to take care of something else. I looked around the house, or as much of it as I could see from the front foyer. There must have been 50 people, from gray-haired elders down to toddlers barely able to stay on their feet. The occasion, Justin's 75th birthday, was being used as an excuse to get the whole clan together. Or as many as could come, anyway. The organized chaos was... No, scratch that. There was nothing organized about this. The chaos was mostly confined to the common areas. Children were not allowed in the kitchen, as the women worked on the meal. Funny. 200 years after original Bob's death, women still ruled the kitchen. Probably, I admitted to myself, because men would have just opened up a bag of chips and a jar of dip. Well, nothing wrong with chips and dip. I looked over the dishes spread out over the dining room table, already being attacked by hungry relatives. They were going all out, and I promised myself I'd try a few things, if only to catalog the taste for VR. I wandered around for a few minutes, saying hello to people and exchanging a word or two here and there. This type of scenario had never been original Bob's forte. Small talk and cocktail party socializing had always seemed so shallow and meaningless. But this was different. Every single person here had some of my DNA, or was married to someone who did. Every single person gave meaning to my life, and the lives of my sisters and parents. I looked around and realized I was stalling. Really, this shouldn't be that difficult. People aged. People grew up, had children, grew old, died. Julia's death still haunted me. Now I was visiting Justin. On his 75th, I could remember the first time I saw him, as clear as the day it happened. 2 years old, sitting on his mother's lap in front of the camera. Space Cadet Justin, laughing in delight at the pretty pictures. With a deep breath, I entered the sitting room. Justin was surrounded by family, chatting, all making sure he was comfortable and wanted for nothing. Justin turned and smiled when he saw me. He raised a hand in greeting, and I smiled back. One of the entourage vacated a chair, and I sat beside him. Hey, Space Cadet, how are things? Justin grinned back at me.
That's Admiral Space Cadet to you, Whippersnapper.
That's Uncle Whippersnapper to you, Admiral. We both chuckled at the exchange. I looked at Justin's face. I could still see Julia in him, which of course meant I could see Andrea. I felt myself starting to tear up and clamped down on it. Instead, I took his hand. Just as well you retired. There's nowhere left to go from Admiral. I hesitated. Justin, we talked a long time ago about replication.
The day my mom died. I remember. Nothing's changed, Will. You guys are still doing chores, and now you're stuck fighting some alien menace for us. It just doesn't seem like much of an afterlife.
Justin tilted his head and looked at me with a small smile.
I know what you think of religion, but right or wrong, I'll die in peace. And Pascal's wager works both ways, right?
I nodded, returning his smile. Yep, if you're wrong, you won't have the opportunity to regret it. Justin was silent for a few moments as he looked around the room.
You know, Uncle Whippersnapper, a lot of the younger ones probably don't even recognize you. You've made fewer and fewer appearances over the years. Is that on purpose? Or just the others thing?
And there it was. The thing I'd been avoiding. But I...